Welcome to Chewing the Yacht. This is Chris Champagne on WAMF FM 90.3 New Orleans. And we have a special guest today, Ms. Sarah Burnett. And we're going to talk to Sarah. She's been in the media, different fields of the media for a while in New Orleans. And I thought she would make a very interesting interview, and I'm sure she will. So I want to thank her for joining us. Thank you, Sarah.
Oh, you're welcome. Anytime.
Well, let's start off with how long have you been in the New Orleans area?
I came to New Orleans in 1971 to go to school at Loyola.
Okay. Okay, so that's how long you've been here, I guess.
From the Chicago area is okay. Where I was living.
Did you grow up in Chicago?
I grew up all over the Midwest. I was born in Madison, Wisconsin, and lived a couple of places there, and I lived in Missouri. And when I went to high school, I was living in the Chicago area. I first was living in Elk Grove Village, which is the suburb that was featured in the movie. I think it was Airport, where the people in the suburbs are looking up and they can practically see the people in the windows of the airplanes.
The airport was right there?
Yeah, O'Hare was so close. And, I mean, the airplanes practically landed on our roof, and then we moved up to closer to the Wisconsin borderline in Antioch, which at that time it was really the country. And now it's gotten to the point where, you know, they even have a train that goes from Chicago to Antioch, so it's more of a commuter town now.
Well, this is kind of an inside, baseball here. But do you get an eerie feeling when you turn onto Antioch?
Yeah, I know, it's so weird.
I was wondering if streets on the way to her house now.
One of the streets on the way to my house. I was thinking about that just today. It's like some things just sort of run through your life, and I guess Antioch is one of them for me.
Well, so you're a Chicago girl in some sense, if you're a teenager and a high school girl.
My dad worked in Chicago for the Pritzker family.
Oh.
And
the governor of Illinois is named Pritzker.
The lawyer?
The governor.
Oh, yeah. I mean, my sister sent me something about one of the sons of that family, who's a director now. But on his Wikipedia page, he's listed as an heir. That's his occupation.
Well, that's a good occupation.
He's an heir.
Yeah. That's a good occupation. It doesn't pay as well, I think.
But anyway, my dad worked on LaSalle Street, so I would go down there sometimes and just hang around in Chicago, and they had two great radio stations there that I listened to all the time, WLS and WCFL. And in those days, you could go and watch the disc jockeys through a big glass window. I used to do that all the time. I just loved it.
This is Bob Elson on WCFL, the voice of labor in Chicago.
Larry Lujack, he was a...
Because we used to get the White Sox games down here.
Oh, okay.
On our radio, and we listened to the commander, Bob Elson.
My mom used to listen to somebody on WGN, I think it was, who used to talk to people at WWL.
Oh, yeah.
The time.
Yeah.
About stuff.
WCFL, the voice of labor. That's how they would end the... You'll go off to commercial break. I would listen to those White Sox games. It's in the early 60s. The White Sox had a really good team. They used to be in contention with the Yankees from 1959 to 1964. They had a good team. In fact, they even were one of the only two teams in like 15 years that actually won the American League pennant besides the Yankees in 1959. The White Sox won the pennant. So, but anyway, I don't have you here to talk about my baseball dreams. So you came to? Did you come to Loyola for broadcasting?
Yep.
Because that was one of the things that people would come there for.
Yep. Yeah. Communications.
Yeah.
And I came like the day after I graduated high school. I hit the road and came here. So I started in the summer before everybody else.
I see.
And got some courses in, and then in the fall in the communications department they had all of WWL's old equipment. Mm-hmm. And Phil Johnson came to talk to us. And, you know, I used to see Hap Lottie on the TV. And I actually ended up working next to him, which was kind of one of those.
On the radio?
Yeah. I was working with him in the later part of his career.
Well, that's a pretty... iconic memory of New Orleans broadcasting. If you don't know who Hap Lottie is, I'm not going to tell you. No, he was Buddy D before Buddy D was Buddy D in a way. In fact, when Buddy D took over his radio show, it was called Hap's Point After. And then it was Hap's Point After with Buddy D, and then Buddy D passed away, so they had to carry on. So now it's New Orleans broadcasting is weird. It's like there was like Scoot, used to be Scoot in the Morning, and then when he was resurrected from whatever graveyard he was in to come back to WWL, which he's on now, it was first it was Scoot in the Morning, in the afternoon.
In the afternoon.
Yeah. So but now he's just, I think he's just Scoot. Scoot now. I don't think he's in the afternoon or the morning or whatever the hell he is. But anyway, so who were some of the people that you went to school with that later?
Bill Capo was one, yeah. And Walt Pierce.
Okay.
Remember him? And,
yeah.
Gosh, if I sit here and think about it long enough, a whole bunch of them will pop up.
Okay,
that was my class.
Well, I just thought maybe there might be some people that people out listening may have heard of in their local, you know, media markets. And what was your first job when you got out of school?
Well, when I got out of school, my first job was at WROA in Gulfport, Mississippi.
Okay.
Stands for Riviera of America.
Oh, well, there you go. I didn't know that. Yeah.
And it was an AM/FM, and it was kind of north of town. And, you know, you had to honk at the chickens in the driveway when you were coming in the morning. And so I did news there. That was my first job. I hadn't really studied news particularly. My field was communications theory, you know, all of that. Mm-hmm. A communicates C through channel B, and, you know, it's just all this crazy stuff. But I liked radio, and so I thought, you know, it might be a fun thing to do. So
we have a nice voice.
I did that, and they had, you know, the FM was totally automated. It had the carousels with the cartridges in it, and it was kind of the easy listening type music, and the AM part was the top 40. You know, coming in early in the morning, you had to go in and change the power on the transmitter when you first came in.
Oh, yeah.
Because
it was high at night.
Yeah, and you had to have your FCC third class license for sure. If you didn't have that, you couldn't be on the air, and I don't know whatever happened. I'm sure mine is up in the attic somewhere. But, so I did that for a few years, and it was great. I mean, there was there were a lot of great stories to come out of that area. Mm-hmm. Lots of them.
We'll share one.
Oh.
Well, you don't have to, but I mean, since you brought it up. I mean,
you know, various crazy crimes that went on, and I don't know. I just remember somebody getting into a fight with the sheriff, one of the reporters getting into a fight with the sheriff, and the sheriff challenging him to meet him on the sand beach to...
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, just a regular...
And the coroner, Ed Little. I was kind of friendly with him, and he invited me to the coroner's convention that they had in Mississippi.
Okay.
This is one of the funny things that happened when I was there.
And well, that's what we're here for.
And so I was sitting at a round table, and guess who was sitting across from me?
A dead person.
Frank Minyard.
Oh, okay. Was he playing his cornet?
He wasn't, but okay. He was. His date for the evening looked like Morticia Adams, like long black hair.
I see.
And they served boiled shrimp, and I didn't really know what to do with boiled shrimp because I had never had it, so I just started eating it without taking the shell off.
Uh-huh.
And everybody, you know, I mean, that kind of betrayed me as not being from there. And so the coroner's convention, it was really interesting. And then after lunch, they showed pictures of autopsies.
Oh, great.
And they told me that I had to leave.
You saw them?
I did. And the coroner told me, Ed Little told me, you know, I hope you do a good story on this because I'd hate to be doing an autopsy on you.
Oh. Well, they wouldn't have had to ask me to leave twice. Because as soon as they said they were going to have autopsies, I would have been out the door before they could tell me I had to leave.
Well, I didn't know what I was... I mean, I figured I was a reporter and I was supposed to stay, but I did leave. And the other fun thing that happened to me there... I got to be pretty good friends with the guy at Keesler Air Force Base.
Okay.
And when the Blue Angels came, you know, a lot of times they'll ask local media people if they want to go up and do a ride. And I got to go up with the Blue Angels. It was really, really, really cool. I was scared.
Yeah, but
it was really cool, especially along the beach. And I have some friends now that I've talked to who have gone up with them recently, and they apparently have cameras now, and you know they can record your whole experience. But
you get to film.
Because it's such a freaky experience. You almost don't remember it. You know, when you're back down on the ground, everything is so intense.
So now you get to see yourself scared to death.
Well, I imagine everybody isn't as scared as I was.
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure everybody has some trepidation if they haven't been in one before.
Man, it was an experience.
It must go like relatively fast.
It does, yes. And at one point, the guy said to me, "Do you want to fly the plane?" I said, "No, I do not want to fly the plane." But once I was back down on the ground, you know, I looked up and I thought, "Man, I was up there."
If they would have asked me, guess what do you think I would have said?
You would have said no too, right?
I would have said, I would have said no, and one condition: I'll fly it. Do we have any bombs? Because if we got bombs, let's go. No. Well, you see that, you know, that's you know, that both of these things I think are one of the good things about being a member of the media is you really, by being part of a news staff, you kind of get to skinny on what's really going on in town, you know, one way or another, through other people or your own reporting. And you also get access to things like you get to ride with the Blue Angels. I mean, that's a pretty cool thing.
I also got to go on a C-130 down to the National Hurricane Center.
Okay.
And that was fun.
Yeah.
Sitting in those big nets that they have, and they showed us how they did at the time, the drop sound or whatever it is, into the hurricanes
and that
kind of thing.
Yeah.
Was neat. I was a big fan of Neil Frank. Remember him?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Did you ever meet Nash Roberts?
No, I never did get to meet him.
You know, it's interesting. I'm going to diverge a little bit here. Just, there's an interesting thing about Nash Roberts that I've never really seen in any of the stuff about Katrina. You know, Katrina was such an unusual event in New Orleans, God, obviously, because the place flooded. But, and of course, in New Orleans, people, historically, they didn't really leave.
Right.
They stayed.
You never hear people leaving for things like, you know.
No. I read someplace after, and I've never read this in any of the things. I've talked about it in one of my shows, but I've never heard it. Nash Roberts had, by the time Katrina was coming, he had retired. And the reason he retired was because his wife was ill. So he retired to take care of his wife. Well, as it turns out, that Katrina was the first time that Nash Roberts ever left the city for a hurricane. Now, if they would have said that on the news, a lot of people would have got out of here.
Everybody would have gone. Yeah.
You know, now I'm not saying they should have done that, but I'm just saying, if that would have happened, you know, that's one of the little tidbits you get from listening to Chewing a Yak with Chris Champagne on WAMF FM 90.3. I always forget to say that, so I have to say whatever I think of it.
I mean, it's well known that he's the one that told everybody on the coast.
Oh, during the...
During Camille.
Camille.
Yeah. That if you're south of the railroad tracks...
Yeah, hit the road, Jack.
Hit the road.
Yeah. Before it's in mind, was you talking about dipping that thing into the hurricane, because he was one of the first people that actually rode through a hurricane, I think, when he was in the Navy, or whatever, he was in the Air Force or whatever, or the Army Weather Service or whatever. Mm. But...
hurricane hunters, they were like big heroes
to me. Yeah. Well, that was, you know, from being at Gulfport, your first gig, that was a lot of... Interesting stories right there, I think.
It was fun. I was only there for 3 years, really. But
where'd you go from there?
Went to Mobile.
Okay.
And I worked at WUNI.
Okay.
And its mascot was the Woonie Bird. It's like a big yellow bird. Anyway, it was a little AM. And it was kind of... It was it called 5 points or 7 points? I can't remember. It was like an intersection of a bunch of roads.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not that familiar with Mobile.
In Mobile. And it eventually got sold to Mel Tillis.
Oh, okay.
And the call letters changed to WMML. No, WMML. And I think it went out of business. It was an old house that they had changed into a radio station. And so I was working there when Hurricane Frederick hit. And that was a big, bad storm in Mobile.
Yeah.
And I thought that was going to be my lifetime storm,
you know.
Yeah. And we spent the night at the station, and you know, at one point the ceiling was kind of bouncing up and down.
Yeah.
And
yeah. You know. How high were y'all on the ground?
Frederick was not a wet storm. It came into the bay and apparently sucked all the water out.
I see.
Before it made landfall. So
the wind was the problem.
It was the wind, yeah. People got really...
Mobile's in a more precarious spot in New Orleans just because it's right there. I mean, if it's coming here, I mean, it's there.
Yeah.
Here, we've got... Even now, we have a little bit of a buffer.
They seem like they get hit pretty frequently to me.
Well, they're more vulnerable. I mean, in general. All right. Any other besides the hurricane stories?
Well, the hurricane, after the hurricane, of course, we didn't have power, but the station had a generator. And I worked with a guy named Doug Walker, who's a reporter, has been a reporter for a long time now, over at WLOX in Biloxi. And he and I had worked together at WROA, and we kind of moved over to Mobile around the same time. And when it was time to go in the morning, he would drive by my house on his motorcycle and shine the light in my window so I would know it was time to get up, because everything was down. And so we would go and talk about, you know, all the stuff that you talk about after hurricane on the radio. I do remember one time I had to go out and fill up the generator with gas. And I'm filling up the generator with gas, and I look over to the side, and about 2 feet away from me is a burning cigarette butt. And so I just kind of stepped over and put it out real quick, but I thought, man, I'm this close to...
Yeah.
So after WU and I went to work for WHIL, which is the public radio station, on the campus of Spring Hill. Yeah. And so I did that gig for a while and just announced and all of that. And before too long, I wanted to get back into news again. So I went to work for WKSJ, which was the big country station there. And it was an AM/FM. And I did morning news, get there real early. And we had a truck, you know, that we rode around town, and we were number one, so everybody always wanted to say hey, and, you know, it was great. People would send us cakes and stuff like that, and I loved working there. I really did. And there was a lot of news in Mobile, you know. Everybody was going to jail.
Everybody in Mobile was going to jail.
Everybody was going to jail, yeah. And so it was an interesting place to work, and I made some good friends there. So
it's the city of churches, isn't it? Isn't that one of its names?
I know it's City of Azaleas. It used to be the home of the Junior Miss Pageant. I don't know if it's still there.
Oh, that's where I was going to jail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was an interesting place to be doing news, but
how was Mardi Gras over there?
It was Joe Kane Day. You heard about that? Uh-huh. He's everybody goes to the cemetery, and that's one of the things that they do. I can't remember. I think he was the founder of Mardi Gras. And they throw moon pies, you know.
Yeah.
So it's okay.
Just Southern Mardi Gras.
Yeah.
Deep-fried Mardi Gras.
They consider themselves to be the
first
original home
of
Mardi Gras.
Yeah. Well,
so
it's okay.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have a lot of parties, of course.
Yeah.
It's fun.
Yeah. Anyway, so you would, so from there you...
Came back here.
Okay.
And went to work at the public radio station here, WWNO, and did the morning drive announcing. And after a few years, I mean, that was fun. I got to do a book show, and I met a lot of authors. I met, Valerie Martin, and I met Dr. Oliver Sacks, the one who wrote The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. He was a pretty unusual guy.
Yeah.
And just anybody who wrote a book, I'd let him come in.
That's a pretty good gig. Huh?
Yeah.
Interesting gig.
It was fun.
I mean, I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah. I really enjoyed it.
What was the name of the show, do you remember?
Gallery.
Gallery.
Yeah. Let's see, it's on a bunch of reel-to-reel tapes somewhere. Big ones.
Yeah.
I'm sure it was terrible, but
no, I'm sure, I'm sure
we had a good time.
I'm sure it was good.
So, and I got to do some hosting of some symphony broadcasts. That was fun. Interview a lot of musicians. I really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. It was good.
How long did you do that?
3 years.
Okay.
And then after that, I went to WWL Radio.
Wow.
And that's where I met Hap, you know.
Sure.
And he used to sit right next to me. Mm-hmm. Cause we would do news from 3 until 6 every day. And I worked across from Dave McNamara and worked with Rob Masson and Walt Pierce, Sabrina Wilson, Mike Franklin. I don't know how many people would remember him.
I remember him. Yeah, he was F. Michael Franklin.
F. Michael Franklin, yeah, the dean of New Orleans radio broadcasters.
He was kind of like the Don Cordo of WWL, if I remember correctly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's an all-star crowd there.
It was
New Orleans.
Yeah,
you know.
It was. We worked in, if you know where WWL TV is, on Rampart Street.
Yeah.
Where we worked was the building right next to them. And it was a very old building.
Mm-hmm.
And full of termites. And, you know, our newsroom was in the back and the studio was in the front. And when you ran to the front to do your broadcast, you would end up picking termites out of your hair. But, you know, that was the Garland and Angela days with TV. And they were right downstairs. And we were all big, happy family. And, you know, Mike Early and all of that stuff. And
okay,
so,
I was going to ask you if there was much, you know, how close you were with the TV side.
Good. We were close.
As far as friends and stuff.
Yeah. Very close.
Okay.
I did that for a few years. And then, you know, the station got sold. And things started to change. And, you know, all this whole AM talk radio type Rush Limbaugh thing started to come in. And so I started to look around for something else. I thought it might be time. There was a, I don't know if you remember this horrible freeze that we had over Christmas one year.
Yeah, I do actually. Yeah.
Was it 88 or 89?
That sounds about right. I don't know what year it was. I remember sitting in the Britannia Theater freezing to death watching a movie because the heating wasn't good.
What were you watching? Do you remember?
Oh my God. You know, I don't remember. I don't remember. But I do remember it was my friend Margot, LaPointe, who was she's from New Orleans, and we were friends in college. And she's a scientist, and she's in charge of the Henry Ford Research Hospital in Detroit, so she's got a really big job. And she was in town for Christmas. And I remember we went to the Britannia to see something, but I can't for the life of me think what it was. But it was like freezing. It was freezing. It was unusual because it really didn't get that cold in those days. I mean, we've had maybe 2 or 3 days a year where it gets kind of chilly here, but it was unusual for it to be so cold. You know, however it was. I guess the heater must not be working, I guess, in the theater. But anyway, so you said you were there for the...
The freeze. It, you know, everything was kind of topsy-turvy with the station and the management and all of that. And then we had this freeze. And I got sent... And when you work in radio, you work pretty much by yourself. You know, covering things and that kind of stuff. And, as opposed to TV, you usually have somebody with you.
Yeah.
But they sent me out to the airport so that I could be the first to report on it when the airport closed. Well, the airport never did close, but, you know, I was sitting out there at the airport and we were looking at the snow coming down and everything, and it was real pretty. And, you know, flights were being canceled. And then they sent me to Kenner City Hall. And I sat around there for a little while, and it was getting pretty bad. You know, the roads were getting pretty bad. And then finally it was the end of the day, and so I was going to come back in by myself. And I mean, to get from Kenner downtown on that day was really, really difficult.
Yeah.
And I was slipping and sliding. It took me like 3 or 4 hours just to get there. And I thought, I don't really think I want to do this anymore. I don't think I really like this as much as it just seemed like it was time to make a change.
Well,
so,
if you're at one of those small radio stations, you probably got most of the choice things because there weren't that many of you, I would assume. your first assignment.
Right.
Whereas if you're here,
well,
you kind of got to take your chances, I guess.
I don't know.
As well, it's supposed to be interesting. I mean,
yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't know. I mean,
I was just getting tired of it, and all the running around, and you know, will there be a parking space for me at City Hall when I go? And you know, then you have to. After a while, all those meetings all the time, and I was just ready to try something new.
Yeah.
My kids were little, and I didn't want to be away from them a whole lot. And so I applied for a job at Audubon Zoo, and I got it.
Okay.
And that was in 1990.
Okay. You were there for quite a while.
On and off.
Well, mostly on.
Yeah, I was there.
Well, that's an interesting gig for sure, I'm sure.
It was great.
So what were you tell people what your duties were, more or less, if you can.
I was a media liaison, mainly. Mm-hmm. So I would help people, help reporters who wanted stories and, you know, prep the zookeepers or whoever were going to be on.
Okay.
To tell the stories. And it was a good time for Audubon in 1990. Mm-hmm. I started the week the aquarium opened.
Oh, okay.
Everybody was so focused.
Yeah.
On that nobody could show me anything. I mean, news people, you know, they don't really know how an office works. And so for me to come in there, I didn't know how to work a fax machine. I didn't know a lot of these office things.
Yeah.
And nobody really had time to show me.
The Office TV show was years ahead of us.
Yeah, that's right. And we didn't have any computers or anything like that then. So... But it was a fun time. It was an exciting time to be at Audubon because things were happening and the zoo was, you know, transforming and the aquarium was transforming the foot of Canal Street and they were getting ready to build the Species Survival Center and we were going to save all the species and save the world. So it was really great.
Yeah, but that was an exciting time to be there for all those reasons. And the insectarium was, I guess, in its... planning stages then, because I think it was planned and then something happened and it was kind of put in the back burner or something for a while before it ended up becoming a reality.
Yeah, that was in the planning stages for a long, long time.
Yeah.
They had talked about a couple of different locations. In fact, there was an old map of the zoo, very old, that showed the aquarium inside the zoo.
Mm-hmm.
And at one time, I think they were talking about putting the insectarium inside the zoo as well, possibly.
Well, there used to be kind of a small aquarium in the zoo from way, way back. That it's that round...
Pathways to the Past.
Yeah, there's something else in there now. Yeah, like dinosaurs or something.
Right.
But that used to be kind of an aquarium where you come in, like an old-timey aquarium where you'd walk in. It was very small. But they had the pit in the middle... And they had, like a tortoise or something in there. And just, you know, it was kind of cool, actually. In fact, last time I went into the zoo, they had the thing that you say, the Pathways to the Past. It's kind of like, man, you know, it was so much cooler when it was that other thing with the actual, you know, fish and stuff. I mean, they still have an element of aquatic stuff at the zoo, mm-hmm. you know, with the white alligators and...
Mm-hmm.
and
in the swamp. Chinese alligators. I used to go to the zoo, you know, when I was in school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I was going to say, you're right there by Loyola. I was going to connect that where you were at Loyola School and you ended up being at the zoo later. So you were kind of like right there.
See the three-legged alligator and the monkey who smoked cigarettes.
Yeah, you see? Well,
yeah.
Well, that's what, well, tell us some animal stories. The monkey that's...
That was before
you started.
Way
the monkey
before
that smoked
my
cigarettes.
Time.
Did y'all bring him cigarettes?
I didn't know. Okay. That was, you know, that's... Remember when Monkey Island was kind of right in the front there?
Sure.
And I mean, everything is so different now that you couldn't...
Not Miss Monkey Island. Maybe the monkeys don't, but I do.
I know.
Yeah, maybe the monkeys do. I mean, I don't know.
Some of the old-timers used to talk about that, how they would sit around with their coffee and cigarettes in the morning and the orangutan would be smoking.
Maybe smoking a cigarette, But none of them volunteered that they would bring in the cigarettes.
No.
I could mean, somebody had to.
I guess so.
I never saw an orangutan at K&B. Couldn't get their own cigarettes.
No, they couldn't. You know, I used to, under my desk at the zoo, I used to have these boxes and boxes and boxes of old newspaper clippings that I was supposed to be working on, you know, cataloging. And, oh, God, it was the most boring thing. But when you got way back there, you know, to read some of these really old stories, it was interesting. Yeah. And when I left the zoo after Hurricane Katrina and went up to Indianapolis and worked at the Indianapolis Zoo for a while, I was thinking, oh, yay, at least I won't have to deal with those clippings anymore. If I didn't have to deal with clippings when I got up there, they put me in a room with all of their clippings. And I said, I don't know anything about this town or what happened here. I am not the good archivist for this. But nobody else wanted to do it. So I was really, really glad to see that whole thing, you know, that physical clipping newspaper article thing go away. And now... towards the end of my career, everything had gone to digital, and we didn't have to deal with all those physical clippings anymore.
But I bet you there's a lot of gems in those physical clippings that aren't online.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
You know, in other words, you go to a library, I would much rather stick my face into a pile of magazines than look online.
I know.
I mean, it's easier to look online, you know, but you can't find everything.
No, you can't.
You know?
You really can't.
And, because, I mean, there's a lot to find. I mean, there's a lot to put on there. I mean, it's like, you know, the amount of things that were written in the press in 1899, let's say, in America, compared to what's written now.
I know.
I mean, you know, because, I mean, every place, every city had, you know, lots of newspapers, for one thing. But anyway, well, how was the Indianapolis Zoo? I mean, is
it... It was nice. It's a nice zoo. It's a, you know, it's...
Is it an older zoo, a younger zoo, or...?
Well, it had moved in the 80s, I think. It was a smaller zoo, and it moved to a better location.
Okay.
And the first day when I went in to work there, I walked into the lobby, and I looked on the wall, and there was a big certificate that was signed by Ron Foreman.
Oh, yeah.
Because he had helped plan this new zoo that opened in the 80s. And I loved it. They had a big group of elephants, and I got a chance to hang out with a baby elephant.
Oh, yeah.
And which is something I had always wanted to do. And they were birthing baby elephants one after the other up there. And
wow.
It was great. I loved it. They had a really beautiful Christmas display. And I did make friends there that I still keep in touch with today.
Okay,
and it was embraced by the community. Everybody loved it.
Well, you're a very affable young woman.
You're
a very affable person, so I'm sure it doesn't surprise me that you would make lasting friends in a brief time.
It was terrific.
Like,
but I didn't stay up there too long. By 2008, I wanted to come home, and so I did. I came home and went back to work at the zoo here.
Well, one of the things that you did at the zoo here was you were liaison between, when the film crews would come.
Yeah.
So, do you have any little anecdotes about that you could share?
Well, I think the first movie that I worked on at the zoo, and what I would do is, it's kind of like from an event planning perspective, almost. You know, I would just work with the crews, and they would always want to do all this crazy stuff. But the first one I worked with, I think, was that one, Undercover Blues. Do you remember that one at all?
You know, I don't remember. I remember the name, but I don't really know what it is.
It was it was directed by Herbert Ross, who I think his next film was Steel Magnolias after that.
Yeah, he's a famous director.
He's a famous director. He was married to Jackie Onassis's sister.
Okay. Lee Radziwill or another one? Okay.
And so Undercover Blues... shot at the zoo, and they also shot in the salt domes.
Okay.
And I heard that part of the shoot was a really grueling shoot. And
salt domes, so not Airbnb.
Yeah. Yeah. If you look at the movie, I think you can tell if you can stand to look at the movie because
you can stand to look at it.
It's everything in the movie. It's beautifully shot, and everything in the movie looks great, including the zoo. But it's kind of a bad movie.
Okay. Oh well. Sorry, Herb.
It had Kathleen Turner and Dennis Quaid in it.
Okay.
And
it's an all-star cast.
Yeah. I mean, it was supposed to be a big movie. And like I said, it was beautifully, from a visual standpoint, it was really pretty. But I remember that this was back in 1990, 91, and they wanted to bring in some alligators for a scene.
Oh, your alligators weren't good enough. Oh, you didn't have any alligators.
Well, they had to be wrangled. The alligators had to be wrangled, and so
Union alligators, baby.
At the zoo, you can't just bring animals in.
No, of course not. No, that's what they won't let me in. Much less animals.
They have to be. There's quarantine issues and all kinds of stuff, but somehow we managed to work through that. And they brought the alligators in, and they put them in the bear exhibit in the Louisiana swamp, which is right across from the actual alligator exhibit. And to keep them in place, they built these chicken wire cages, big chicken wire cages, that they submerged in the lagoon, but they were almost to the surface, and they attached the actor alligators to the chicken wire so that they couldn't crawl up on the ground, so that they had to stay in the water. I mean, this is terrible. And if you look at the movie, there's a scene in it, and Stanley Tucci is in a tree. He plays the bad guy. And he's in a tree.
Isn't he always?
And somehow, for some reason, he had to take off his clothes while he was
in the tree,
and that was the shtick of the scene. And I thought, man, I feel so sorry for that guy. And I especially feel sorry for him now because he's become such a great actor, there he is in a tree taking off his clothes with alligators.
With civilized actor alligators.
Actor alligators. there was a guy named Deputy Jeff who used to be the sort of resident animal wrangler for movie crews and stuff like that, and I think he's still around doing things, but he was the one who was handling all that, and somehow he managed to convince everybody that it would be an okay thing to do. So, and Kathleen Turner, she was kind of
weird,
a little bit. There was a scene where she had to pretend like she was having a fit. And she didn't like the way people were hovering over her, so she...
You need room to have a fit.
Yeah, and she yelled about that. But we took her on a tour of the zoo, and we gave her an elephant ride, and she was really nice.
Oh, there you go. Okay. That's all you got to do.
And Dennis Quaid was pretty nice. He seemed like he was having a good time. He had lunch with the crew, and, Meg Ryan was there with the stroller, walking the baby around, so... It was a fun, it was a big deal movie.
Yeah, it sounds like it,
And it was fun for us, and they invited us all to the
premiere
when it was here in New Orleans.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, it was good.
Did you go?
Yeah, I sure did.
Mm-hmm. Was it fun?
Yeah, it was great. I mean, it was, for all the work we did, to see the little piece of the movie that it ended up being was kind of disappointing because we thought we'd have a bigger...
That's kind of like... That's how it is. Yeah, I mean, I've been in a couple of movies, and by mistake, of course. Whatever you do in the media, it's like, it's always, if they interview you, it doesn't come out right, or at least you think it doesn't come out right, and you're usually right, actually, because you know yourself better than they do. If you do TV, they cut the best place, your funniest stories out. Same thing in a movie. I mean, the things that you want to be in, they never seem to never get in.
Right.
That's how that goes, I guess. So how about any other interesting movie stories?
One of the more recent ones was the Bad Lieutenant movie with Nicolas Cage. That we were there very first day of shooting. In the zoo, they have scenes of him walking around looking for something in a trash can or something like that. It was a very long day shooting.
Those things really, it's very tedious sometimes making film.
And the first day, nobody really knows what's going on. And I remember that we had set everything up for them in the parking lot of the zoo, not realizing that the gift shop was having their annual Christmas sale. And so all the people were coming in to try to get their stuff from the gift shop, and there's all this movie stuff all over the place.
Yeah.
But Nicolas Cage, he was very interested in animals, and we found him wandering around over by the leopards and the primates and stuff like that. And he spent a long time talking to our primates curator about... various things, and ended up donating a two-headed snake to the zoo.
Well, so that was everybody has a two-headed snake to donate, but
that's right.
if anybody had one, it would probably be him, I guess. But
So that was fun. I mean, usually, like the movies and the TV shows and the commercials and stuff like that, it can be a disruption to the
regular
to people who are trying to do their jobs and.
Yeah, and to the people who come to the zoo, too, probably.
Yeah, people who are coming to the zoo.
I mean, in this day and age, I would seem that there must be, like, boo-hoo laws about how you have to treat animals. So, So I would assume now they probably don't really use your animals.
No, they don't.
Is background. Mm-hmm. They don't use them to do anything. And like you said, they would bring their own actor animals in if they needed them.
Right.
And they probably computer generate them now, too, if they have to. So I was going to ask if there are any interesting, you know, animal stories with the films, but I guess that wouldn't even come into play because they don't use your animals.
No, they don't. But some, you know, they'll push. They'll push and push and push. And I was working with one crew, and, you know, they always neglect to tell you little things like, oh, by the way, we're going to be using a crane. We're bringing a crane in, and we're going to be swinging a crane all around. And that happened one time with a crew, that they brought in a crane, and everything was going fine with the crane until they swung the crane over the orangutan exhibit. And that could have gone bad in so many different ways, and we were just lucky that it didn't, because I don't even like to think about...
Yeah, I mean, if the orangutan would have like grabbed one of it or something, depending on how low it was... I mean,
yeah,
I put it out of there and gotten hurt too, you know. Mm-hmm. And
But scenes like that, you know, we try to do mainly when the zoo is closed.
Yeah.
So it doesn't affect people so much, except for maybe with the parking. We've been doing a lot of renting out the parking lot for productions.
Equipment.
Yeah, because there aren't that many places to park uptown.
Right.
And a lot of them use...
Yeah. How about the aquarium? Have you had many requests for that, for TV or movies?
Well, not as many, but some.
Yeah.
Trying to think what were some of the ones that we've had down there. It's so much more of an enclosed space.
Sure.
That it's harder to...
Again, it would probably just be for background.
Yeah.
As opposed to actually dumping somebody into the tank.
Well, you know, we've hosted, happily and successfully, we've hosted NCIS there a couple of times. And they've been great to work with. We've really enjoyed it. And one of the things we worked with them was putting a couple of their people in the shark tank.
Okay.
That was a tough sell to the animal people. Staff. Yeah. But they satisfied all the safety requirements and all the certification requirements, and they had a nice fancy piece of equipment that they donated to the husbandry department afterwards. So they've been real good neighbors for us.
Yeah.
And then this last time they were there, there was an episode this past season where somebody was jumping off the roof of the aquarium. It was kind of interesting.
Okay.
That was a fun shoot, complicated.
Has there any requests for the insect in that place yet?
Not really. We get a lot of editorial type requests for that. You know, news crews want to come in and taste the bug dishes and
I got asked to go to do a, they had a bug dinner at an art gallery, and I went, they asked me, I have a bug poem in my poetry book, Roach Opera. So they asked me to come read my poem, you know, and I could be part of the festivities, you know, and I get to eat the bugs. But I mean, you know, I mean, that's a, to me, that bug eating is a crock, because they put honey on it.
I know.
Or they put, you know, a wafer with it, or a cookie, or chocolate. And I mean, you know, it's like eating a box of Milk Duds that's empty. That's what it tastes like, pretty much, like cardboard.
Well... you know, Zach Lemon makes some pretty good stuff.
Well, maybe, I don't know.
My favorite was Crispy Cajun Crickets.
Oh, Crispy Cajun Crickets.
I love that one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. They sell that at the zoo?
At the insectarium, they let people sample it.
Yeah, let people, they won't sell it, though. They just sample it.
Right.
Just to give them an idea of what's possible.
Right.
Well, actually, I think in some places in the world, I mean, that's a staple of their diet is insects because of their protein.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so,
and grubs.
Grubs, yeah.
And things
that. Yeah, grubs. My favorite. I mean, I went to Galatos once and I said, you know what? I just realized there are no grubs on this menu, so I'll see you later. I'm tough. I mean, what can I tell you?
But fair.
Yeah. Oh, way more than fair. I bend over backwards. I'm like Red Panda, if you know who that is. She's an acrobat that does things she was at the last Pelican game I went to. They talk about the NBA players being the greatest athletes in the world. That's how they. So there's this Asian lady. Her name is Red Panda. She goes out there on a unicycle, and she puts like bowls, like soup bowls, on her top of her foot and throws them up in the air and catches them on her head. Okay, and sometimes she does two, and she does three, and she does four, and she always gets them. They just sign her up. I don't know what she can do, but they need to sign her up. But Fred Panda. Well, I'm trying to think. I mean, you know, that has to be a pretty interesting gig. I mean, just in general, working at a zoo, plus a very nice zoo like
yeah,
that one.
Yeah, it is.
You know,
it was
a top
really
zoo.
Great.
And if you like animals, and I know that you do,
mm-hmm.
it must be kind of cool just to walk around and, you know.
Every day, walk around the zoo. And I got a chance to help hand raise a baby orangutan, which I never thought I would.
Yeah,
I mean, never, ever in my life thought
I
would.
You know, I thought I would, but I guess it's not going to happen now. But I'm sure.
It was so great.
Are there any animals that you miss now that you're not there anymore? You know, you walk around every day and you see this one near your, you know, wherever you would walk on your daily rounds from parking lot to.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Well, I didn't mean to bring it back.
Yeah.
I don't want to make it nostalgic now. But
the animals were definitely the best part about being there.
She didn't say that, people. Okay.
I didn't say that.
No. Well, you know, like Nicholas Kristof, okay, the columnist for New York mm-hmm. Times, he wrote an article one time that says the most noble creature he's ever met in his life is a goose. Now, I don't know how his wife feels about this. You know what I mean? So if he drives me up the wall, Nicholas does, and I've often thought about writing him a letter, and if I let on the envelope, I'm going to put, Nicholas Kristof, the man who loves goose.
Well, I mean, I think anybody you would talk to who works at the zoo would say that.
That the animals are the best part.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, all right, then I'll let
you
go.
Yeah, anybody would say that.
No, it's okay with me.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, I'm just, you know, I got into a fight with a goose once at the zoo.
At the zoo?
And he just screamed at me, you know, because they like that.
Yeah.
So I screamed back at him because I'm like that too. And he, you know, he didn't, and of course, I guess if he would have jumped across the little pond and over the little fence and we would have gotten into a fight, I'm sure I would it wouldn't have went well for me. Not necessarily to fight, because I'm sure that they're tougher than they look, but but so am I, as it turns out.
Okay.
So goose are a little, you know, they're a little, they can be hard.
Oh, definitely.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they can be hard. And I always wonder why the flamingos didn't fly off, though.
Well,
they cut their wings?
Yeah.
Yeah. I knew it was subversive.
They don't cut their wings. They do something with their feathers.
Okay.
They don't cut, like, I don't know.
They take out their adrenal gland while they're
looking. No, they don't do. No.
They take out their
like
kidneys,
that.
So they have to stay close.
Nothing like that. Maybe in the 1940s they did that.
But well, they have the flamingos at. They used to have the flamingos at Hialeah, at the racetrack, and they used to be in the infield. And they would fly, you know?
Fly away?
No, they didn't fly away. They would
just fly around.
And they'd come right back.
Yeah.
You know, I guess they knew where the, you know, where the peanut butter and jelly sandwiches were, I guess. I don't know, you know? But I assume they must have done something to them. Because they can fly.
Mm.
You know what I mean? And at some point, if you've been a flamingo at Hialeah for like 6 years, you might say, let's fly to Cuba or something. You know what I mean? Let's get out of here. We can come back, you know. But so they had to do something to him to get him to stay, like an invisible fence or something. Well, what about, we haven't talked too much about at all, except that you mentioned it, the survival center. I mean, how's that when you left? In what shape did you leave that? What's going on over there?
Well, there's a, the survival center opened in 1993. And that's a big piece of land. It's actually Coast Guard land that we're on. And it opened with the purpose of breeding endangered species. You know, there's not that much space in zoos, really, if you put all the zoos together and think that you're trying to save endangered species in zoos. It's not very much land at all. And so some zoos have done this, National Zoo and San Diego Zoo and a few others, where they open up off-site sort of large breeding facilities, and some of them are open to the public and some of them aren't. And the one that we have over on the West Bank was not open to the public. Okay. And so there was breeding of, I remember we did red wolves and tapirs and a whole variety of species. But the thing that, the program that really was the most successful was the Mississippi Sandhill Crane program. And we were hatching out chicks every year from that, with, and it was the full gamut of, you know, assisted reproduction and hand raised and then released into the wild, into the semi-wild, at the Mississippi Sandhill Crane Refuge. And so that was great. And then a little bit later on, we opened up the Audubon Center for Research of Endangered Species, and that was a center that was doing all kinds of interesting assisted reproduction for endangered species. And I got, that was where I got to work with a lot of different film crews, and foreign film crews, Japanese and BBC, and just lots and lots
of
different
documentaries.
Mm-hmm, doing documentaries. And I ended up going, one thing that I did that is the best memory for me is I ended up going to Kenya with the BBC because we were doing some procedures with Eland at Mount Kenya Safari Club. And so that was a cool trip.
Yeah, I bet. And how long were you there?
We were there about a week. Okay, but, you know, when you're going someplace to work, you really don't get a chance to do a lot of the, you know, touristy things. So I do remember going into Nanyuki and seeing the spinners and weavers there. And, you know, it was quite an experience.
I bet. Yeah,
it was
really
great.
Well, you know, I read an article in the New York Times maybe a month ago, about Chinese traditional medicine. And, you know, zoos now in this world, I'm not going to say politically correct, but I'm going to say this correct world, this perfect world in which we must live now, or we're evil. Zoos are not, they're frowned on by a lot of people because of the incarceration, basically, of the animals, I guess. I don't know. But it's like, you know, these rare animals, I mean, their only hope is a zoo at some point, it seems to me, because these lunatics in China are pushing this stuff now, and they're just, you know, killing these animals just for their parts. You know, and they say they're going to, like, it's medicinal, which it probably doesn't do anything.
It's like rhino horn is like your hair.
I know, it's like a fingernail.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's right. But so I'm saying, you know, things like the survival center, or it's good that people are doing those things now, because at some point, the lessons that are learned in these places will, I think, come soon, are going to be very valuable to save the existence of these animals.
Well, you know, a lot of people don't realize that all of the zoos in the country work together really closely with endangered species.
Conspiracy.
And there are groups that, you know, monitor the genetics of all of the animals.
At a moment's in the Illuminati.
And they determine where animals will travel and who's going to be breeding, yeah. and just to make sure that the gene pool...
Right, so they end up like the Spanish royal family. Yeah. Well, Sarah, I think we've run out of time, and I certainly want to thank you for taking the time to come on Chewing a Yak, WAMF, FM Radio 90.3 New Orleans. This is Chris Champagne, and there were a couple of other issues I wanted to get to, but maybe we'll have you back on.
Okay.
But thank you, Sarah, so much.
Sure.
Very interesting. Very interesting.
Right.
Thanks.
This program is produced by WAMF 90.3 FM in New Orleans, Louisiana, and distributed by Affiliated Media Foundation Movement to our sister stations WDSV 91.9 FM in Greenville, Mississippi, and KABF 88.3 FM in Little Rock, Arkansas. For more information, please visit our website at affiliatedmediamovement.org.